Dan Coats is leaving the Trump administration. Democratic presidential candidates face off in the second round of debates, plus an FBI raid in South Bend, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 2nd, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, President Trump announced in a tweet what had been long rumored. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats is leaving the administration. Coats and Trump have often clashed in the 2.5 years the former Indiana senator has led the country's intelligence community. While Trump has downplayed or denied efforts by Russia to interfere in U.S. elections, Coats recently hired an election security chief. There was also this viral moment from last year.
The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
Vladimir Putin coming to the...
Did I hear you? Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Coats also contradicted Trump in congressional testimony over North Korea and ISIS. The president said he will nominate Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe to replace Coats. What impact has his time in the Trump administration had on Dan Coats' legacy? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Now, I should say that it turns out that the president apparently has pulled John Ratcliffe back from consideration for the job, but how does Dan Coats look as he departs D.C.?
Well, I mean, in sharp contrast with Vice President Pence, he's proven that he hasn't sold his soul to the devil. He only leased it. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, he stood there and took a job from a guy who lies about everything, who contradicts him on all the important points and on the intelligence community in general about the Russian involvement in the 2016 election, and basically demeans anybody who works for him, and he stayed there. Now, we can argue about why he stayed there, whether it was out of his sense of duty to the country or whether it was because he wanted to be part of the action. I don't know what the reason is. But the fact of the matter is that anybody who is in that administration and close to that president, when you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. And it's got to hurt his reputation for staying there when those kinds of shenanigans are going on a daily basis.
It struck me as interesting that he stayed a lot longer than a lot of other folks in the intelligence and defense apparatus in the upper echelons of the Trump administration, almost everyone other than arguably Mike Pompeo, despite the fact that I can think of few people in the administration who publicly contradicted the president more often.
Well, I think it speaks to the job he did while he was there. I mean, he was responsible for coordinating all these intelligence agencies, these 16 agencies across the federal government. He always gave, in his view, what he honestly believed was real, the real threats against America, and supported it with facts. And people that know better or who know believe that behind the scenes, these intelligence agencies are working almost better than they ever have before because they're sharing information, they're all coordinated, and there was a real... There is, and now there's an open-ended question about who's going to step into that, but the Ratcliffe, the presumption that he was going to come in and lead that agency caused a lot of concern because he just didn't know how to do that. He just wasn't qualified to go do that. But I think the way Dan Coats handled himself and conducted himself in this administration, the job he did, will reinforce his legacy as someone who was always the grown-up in the room, put country first, and was a real patriot no matter the circumstances and the political context around him.
Obviously, the full story of the Trump administration will be written at least starting in either a year and a half or 5.5 years, depending on when his administration ends. But as Dan Coats comes out of it, did he come out of it, or is he coming out of it about as well as you think he could have?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, his reputation is intact. He, I think, is widely viewed as someone who put country first, who put before partisanship and was able to avoid some of the kowtowing that took place in other sectors of the federal government with other appointees, which is reassuring given that the position that you're talking about here was directing national intelligence and trying to bring together the herding the cats that are, as Mike suggested, the various agencies, which we've seen historically is an impossibility. I mean, they used to almost war against each other, among each other, the way they'd, you know, as if they were foreign adversaries. And now, fortunately, as a nation, we've come together in a better way. It's going to be interesting to see, though.
They all joined in a war against the president.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, especially with John Ratcliffe now apparently out, whether Sue Gordon, the number two, who's been in the intelligence community for 30 years and is well-liked on both sides of the aisle in Congress, will be the acting director, if not, never mind.
Well, which is a theme in the Trump administration.
But that's also,
maybe permanent. Yeah.
Well, but that's also federal law that she be named acting director. And the White House has already signaled no. They want to have...
She's a woman.
Well, I don't know about woman. She's also a part of the state.
It's obviously really hard to say how will history remember Dan Coats and his time in the Trump administration right now. But given the fact that he publicly so often contradicted the president and didn't do it in an antagonistic way necessarily, just said this is what the intelligence community believes, will that help boost his reputation?
Oh, it certainly helps. And frankly, I'm impressed that he got out of there without Trump denigrating him via tweet.
Yes.
I mean, very few people who leave that administration don't get attacked by Trump. So the fact that he held his tongue on that alone, I think, speaks to the respect that a lot of the other Republicans in the administration have for Dan Coats.
I think something people forget about Dan Coats is that, especially in this Russian interference context, remember, it was 5 years ago that Russia banned him from traveling to the country. So he was railing on Russia before it was cool.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, how did his service in the Trump administration affect Dan Coats' legacy? A, it improved it. B, it damaged it. Or C, it had no effect. Last week's question, should Indiana move away from its A to F grading system for schools? 86% of you say yes, 14% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Democratic presidential candidates, including South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, took part this week in the second round of primary debates. The first night of the debates largely featured top-tier candidates Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders parrying attacks from more moderate candidates in the primary field, yielding perhaps the most viral moment of the second round of debates between Warren and former Maryland Congressman John Delaney.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
Pete Buttigieg shied away from attacking his fellow Democrats and instead sought to contrast himself more with President Trump and Republicans.
And if you were watching this at home and you are a Republican member of Congress, consider the fact that when the sun sets on your career and they are writing your story of all the good and bad things you did in your life, the thing you will be remembered for is whether in this moment with this president you found the courage to stand up to him or you continue to put party over country.
Thank you, Senator Sanders.
Mike O'Brien, did Buttigieg stand out enough in the second debate?
I don't think he did, but I don't think he really needed to either. He's already hit the metrics for the narrowing of the September debates with, you know, having more donors, 130,000 donors now, you know, 400 unique in 20 states, kind of, et cetera, whatever the criteria is. So he's already, there's seven that have met that threshold. And he's one of them. So he didn't have to, all he had to do was kind of not screw up and just kind of get to the stage where there's only 8 or 10 of these people left. The notable thing, I think, in night one was how divided Democrats are ideologically on what is the right path here between progressives and people that want a more candidates that want a more moderate approach by Democrats. Night two was bizarre because they made it look like Obama was too far right for this group. They attacked him on health care and immigration. They attacked Biden and Obama on health care and immigration. President Obama is the most popular Democrat in the country right now. And the two signature achievements that coming out of that administration are now being attacked as too Republican, I guess. It was bizarre how the attacks on Obamacare and Biden is not going far enough when most of the country is still not sold on on Obamacare, and they're certainly not sold on Medicare for All. So the storylines coming out of this debate I don't think were helpful at all for Democrats.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, what Mike was just talking about, which is Joe Biden is still the front runner in every poll, even if that is shrinking now. But he's still the front runner in every poll, which means a lot of folks are trying to attack him and knock him back.
Sure.
Obviously, one way to do that is to criticize his role in the criticize the Obama administration. Is
well,
that going to go over well?
Criticize his votes from earlier in his
career. Sure, absolutely. There's some of that. But we saw that on
No,
Wednesday
I know.
Night.
I understand that. And I frankly don't think that Joe Biden will be in or be the front runner when this is all over. So it's a different situation. I thought that Pete Buttigieg did a great job of positioning himself, and he is a moderate. I mean, I think his position, for example, on student loans is exactly the right position. We should not be guaranteeing for-profit student venues because they are predatory, and they are hurting so many people. We ought to have a way to work your way out of it based on income, and you can't do that under the Trump administration. And we ought to be thinking about how to help keep college costs down, which was what his position is. He's got student loans. He's not advocating giving them up. He's not advocating Medicare for All. He is saying, in addition to private insurance, it would be nice if there was a government alternative.
A public option,
and people are very much in favor of that. And by the way, for all the Republican criticism of Obamacare, you've been in control for the last 3.5 years, still have not come up with an alternative, have you?
No, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
I mean, no, really. I mean, for years on this show, I've been saying we need an alternative, and a public option was originally a Republican idea back in the day, but
so was Obamacare.
Right.
So was Obamacare, but we get kind of blinded by the politics.
Is Mike right? Because the next debates are the higher threshold, and you're going to naturally cut maybe half of this group up or off. Did Buttigieg just need to not make any mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, he put in another steady, solid performance. He didn't, you know, embarrass himself, but he also didn't have the moment, as everyone says.
He didn't attack others. Right.
No, he didn't attack anyone. And that's great for him. I mean, you know, when I read various breakdowns of the debates from all different levels, you know, he was frankly not mentioned, and that's not great, but, you know, I guess didn't help, didn't hurt.
Is this the last time he can get away with a didn't help, didn't hurt performance, though?
I think he is doing just fine. And if he stays, again, he needs to stay in that pack or that second pack, you know, depending on how you analyze it, there's this cluster. It's sort of like a distance race or a mile. You know, you don't want to be out front when you're the rabbit, you know, setting the pace, because then you're going to burn out and everybody can pace themselves based on your performance. You want to be over that person's shoulder. I know sports.
I don't
over the shoulder or a few back where you can sort of size it up, save your kick for the end. Because we've seen what happens when people go out of their way to have a bold debate performance. Kamala Harris set herself up as a target for the next debate. That's when true. Then everybody said, okay, she really came out a winner in that one. We got to come tear her down. Yeah. And that's what happened. And she didn't perform as well in terms of responding in this, you know, this back and forth as she did when she had what presumably were scripted attacks on the front runner.
Or prepared attacks.
Well, she scripted them, or appear
so
at least.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think there's this is not a time necessarily to be crazy bold
in your
performances.
All right. Well, the day after Pete Buttigieg stood on a debate stage in Detroit this week, the FBI raided the South Bend Housing Authority. Neither the FBI nor the U.S. Attorney's Office will confirm what the Bureau's presence at the South Bend Housing Authority's offices is about, but the agency has been plagued by mismanagement and financial issues in recent years. And Mayor Pete Buttigieg has long been a critic. The Housing Authority isn't part of the city administration, but he does appoint the board of the Housing Authority, and in 2015 fired the entire board and replaced them. Buttigieg also appeared before the board at a meeting last fall to criticize the agency. John Schwanis, what kind of, because he doesn't oversee the agency directly, but it's his hometown and it's where he's mayor, what kind of a risk does this pose to people?
I don't think it poses a serious risk unless the investigation, if there is in fact an investigation, which the U.S. Attorney's Office will only say there's some sort of activity.
Yes,
so if this
like
activity yields an investigation, which in turn yields something that points fingers at misjudgments on the part of the administration, which again is it hard to kind of figure unless all of the people he appointed to the board in 2015 after he fired en masse
the entire board,
if they are all the problem, which I think the history of this doesn't look like it, well, then he'd have a problem. But otherwise, the only downside for him is, as was the case with the earlier police shooting, it becomes part of the narrative. Instead of every time a national story talks about what he's done in South Bend, it's not just about, you know, the 1,000 projects in 1,000 days or whatever. It's
and the Studebaker plan and all that.
And those types of things. It's oh, and by the way, he had to deal with this shooting. Oh, and by the way, even though it wasn't of his doing, of his making, there is this controversy or this scandal, that potential scandal brewing. So you don't want to have it, but I don't think it's going to hurt him.
Yeah, we always talk about, do things have legs? Is this the sort of thing that has legs for people?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, until we know what exactly they're investigating, whether it's the board members he appointed or they are accused of wrongdoing or something like that, I don't think we know. I will say this. I don't think the general voter out there is going to distinguish between it not being a part of the city administration. I mean, it's a board in South Bend that he appoints all the members to. So, I mean, I think if there's any damning information, it will definitely
Hurt. Is that the biggest problem for
him? Well, that's why it was done. Okay? You can't tell me that of all the housing agencies throughout the country with problems, and he's been out in front of this problem for years, they choose the night after the debate to target South Bend.
I don't know why Joe
this
Biden
is
did
the
that.
Most,
why would Joe Biden do that?
This is the most political attorney general we have seen since John Mitchell and Nixon. Okay? And is he playing politics with the FBI? You're darn right he is. And that's what this is all about. And shame on him and shame on them for falling.
You just
to
made
it.
That up.
There's I didn't like, make it up.
Well, but this
you
hold on,
you
let
tell me
this,
there
though.
Are no other housing agencies with problems?
I don't think Ann will be the only person who thinks that. So does that actually mitigate, if there is anything damaging that comes out of this, does that mitigate some of it for some people that they go, well, that's convenient?
You got to jump through a couple of hoops to get there. I mean, to Nikki's point, I mean, like, that's the South Bend Chocolate Factory could have, like, problems right now, and they'd go, see, here's just another Pete Buttigieg failure. You know? So, yeah, I mean, so to John's point, it builds into this narrative that you keep hearing these South Bend something problems, and it doesn't matter. It's like, well, that's another political
so even though the FBI going to go next?
I'll say this. Right. Notre Dame had better have a pretty good season this year.
No one even knows that's in Indiana.
All right, well, the Indiana Election Commission recently approved the first paper backups for electronic voting machines, but it could take up to a decade before such equipment is available to every county that needs it. 58 Indiana counties use direct record electronic voting machines, which do not have a paper trail that a voter can see. The Indiana Election Commission approved what are called voter verifiable paper audit trails, which will be added to those electronic machines, offering voters a paper record of their ballot. However, the General Assembly only provided enough money in the new state budget to equip 10% of electronic voting machines with the paper trails, and counties will only get a few of the paper backup systems at a time, so not all voters will have access to it immediately. By 2029, all machines statewide must have that equipment. Nikki Kelly, the way the state plans to distribute these machines this time around has some counties balking, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the General Assembly gave enough for 10%. So the general plan for the Secretary of State's office is to give enough of this equipment to each county to equip 10% of their machines. And, you know, some counties are a little concerned about that. And I don't blame them because, you know, like Allen County has 715 machines. So they're going to do a little more research. But how do you say, okay, you voter over here, you get a trail, but these nine voters over right. here don't. I mean, how do you disperse those out in the county where some voters are treated differently than others?
Yeah, I mean,
that's called gerrymandering, I think, isn't that?
Well, I mean, there was already criticism of, oh, you only gave money for 10% right. of the machines that everybody says we need. But is the problem compounded by the way they're choosing to do it, which is give a little bit to a lot of counties instead of say, all right, we're going to pull from Manhattan. This county get taken care of.
Well, that doesn't always work as well. Look at the pilot programs. Let's do five counties or with school, or, you know, early childhood education, yeah. and then there's controversy about why they're not here. I don't know if there's a good way to do it other than to pony up the money that's necessary to do all of the machines properly so that there are paper trails and do it right. I think what is happening here is you have the hope that this effectively incentivizes the notion that you have some money, 10%, to get counties to do it on their own.
So much extra
or
money, right?
There's always the hope in all state legislatures probably, and this is in the back of the
that
mind.
The federal government.
Feds have looked at this, and we've talked about it on the show before, with the White House blocked it the first time, bipartisan effort, and that would have had funding. So maybe there's a smart
Moscow
money bet
Mitch
here. There's a smart money bet that the money will be there at the federal level.
Is this, Connie Lawson, in the statement she provided when these machines were just voted on and approved, was, you know, this is going to give voters more confidence that the system is working the way it should, and it's going to allow us to do audits, risk-limiting audits, after an election. What she's then saying, of course, is for those counties that don't get these machines or those voters who don't have access to these
exposed,
machines.
Right?
Yeah.
I think there were a couple things, a couple of pragmatic things here. One, these aren't wholesale replacements of voting machines.
It's add-on.
It's an add-on feature that had to be created, and then it had to go through the approval process, and then it actually has to be built. And I think there were logistical concerns about, okay, here's how long that's going to take, and it's not practical to say we're going to have these deployed in 92 counties by the primary next year. Couple that with the Senate Intelligence Committee coming out this week and saying, well, it wasn't just three states that may have been exposed. It was every single state that was exposed and may have been, in Indiana, what wasn't in that situation, wasn't compromised. But look, it's going to take, and Congress hasn't done its job, and the White House hasn't done its job, they're so focused on Trump campaign collusion that they're not paying attention to, hey, we got to vote again in 2020, and now we know for a fact that Russia, on a wide-scale basis, tried and succeeded in some cases, at least from an information campaign,
to interfere in
the election. And they've done really nothing, and they've left it to the states. Now, part of this is it's a fundamental change, not just in adding this device to these machines, it's a fundamental change in how we vote. I mean, we have county clerks and county election boards in 92 counties that vote for and approve and purchase voting equipment, and we've always done that.
And this is a system where the
and
state
now
is buying
we're coming
machines
in and going,
and
wait a minute, the federal government has figured out all this, all these
I'm
problems.
I'm going to mention swine barn might be involved in your answer.
But I mean, the difference in the way we've always done it is we never had the threat of a foreign hostile power interfering in our elections before this. Drastic action is taken. $50 million, you're right, for the swine barn. We can't raise teacher pay. We can't guarantee the sanctity of our elections. Connie Lawson said before that these were all safe, okay? That's not true. And now they're telling us it could take 10 years to make the election safe. Is that supposed to restore confidence? They need to allocate the money. They
it's
need
a shame
to do it
we
now.
Don't have some big pot of money sitting there.
You
that
do.
We could
you have a surplus.
Take some one-time money from.
Surplus.
Yeah, sarcasm.
Yeah. Yeah, how about that?
All right.
That's
well,
what it's for.
The Washington, D.C. journalism outlet National Journal recently put Indiana on its list of governor seats most likely to flip in the next two election cycles. Governor Holcomb ranked 10th out of 10 in the National Journal's rankings of seats most likely to change parties. First is Montana, an open seat this year, while second on the list is Indiana's neighbor to the south, Kentucky, where Republican Governor Matt Bevin faces a tough re-election fight in 2019. The National Journal notes that at a different time in politics, as it said, Pete Buttigieg would have made the most sense to run against a Republican incumbent, Holcomb, who only won by 7 points in 2016. Michael Bryan, I think I know the answer to this one, but would you put Eric Holcomb on a list of 10 governor seats most likely to flip?
Well, I think if you look at the context of the next two cycles, there's 14 governor's races. We mostly elect governors in this country in the midterm elections. So in 19 and 20, there's 14. If you take like North Dakota and Utah and Mississippi and Delaware off the list, right, states that are never going to flip, you're left with 10. So Indiana's the least likely of the sure things to
Well, you know, the difference is that
they had Democrat governors, to be fair, in the past. Yeah. So if you look at all those, you go, well, Indiana has flipped in the past.
I think they listen to Mitch Daniels. Every 16 years, you have to weed the garden. It's time to be weeding.
All right, well, finally, it's the start of the 2019 Indiana State Fair, which means there are new fair foods to try. That includes the Indiana Pork Barbecue Split, which is served in a boat with three scoops of pulled pork, mac and cheese, and coleslaw with a pickle on the side. There's also the Dairy Bar's Hoosier Hometown Hash, which is two hash brown patties surrounding four types of cheese. And for dessert, you can grab a deep-fried chocolate chip cookie ice cream sandwich. Now, Andalani, are you planning to try any of these delectable options?
Am I planning to fry any of these delectable
you
items?
You could fry
I
all
mean,
of those things.
I think
want.
I may have to take a pass. I'm sorry. I know that's probably not the Hoosier answer, but none of those are
I'm a traditionalist.
Attractive.
Lemon shake up and, you know, maybe
Italian
pork
sausage or pulled pork.
If you eat
pork.
Two of the hash brown things, you get an angioplasty at the medical tent. They'll throw it in.
I was going to say, I mean, you have to, like, run around the state fairgrounds a couple of times after one of these meals,
right? Do they have a blood draw to test your cholesterol while you're there, too?
Do they do it behind the glass, like in the vet clinic, like they do the spay and neutering while you're getting your pacemaker put in? Is it become an attraction? See Mike O'Brien.
Maybe that's from the new swine barn. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.